My beloved brethren and sisters in the glorious hope of Israel. I think more than I expected, we can appreciate the words of Brother Ewan yesterday as we consider the time periods of the apocalypse this morning. I must confess I wasn't actually anticipating that it would really support some of the things we say this morning as much as Brother Ewan did yesterday. Because essentially, if we remember, the burden of his address was essentially to dispel, or rather, bolster the correct view of the apocalypse, namely that it is a book of continuous historic predictions. And really, it would be a totally fruitless exercise to stand here and argue or discuss the time periods of the apocalypse if we understood that it was a futurist or a preterist interpretation. So I think Brother Ewan's remarks really did prepare the way very well for our considerations this morning and throughout the weekend. And what we hope to do is we could make this a very boring address and just give this the start date of each time period and when it ended, but we'd like to sort of just consider the context of the beginning and ending of each period that we hope to look at this morning to hopefully expand our understanding of the time periods and perhaps make them a little bit easier to remember. Because I must confess, despite looking at some of the time periods, like the 1260 days and the 42 months, I still have to think in my head what starts each and why does it start at that date. So, why are time periods then necessary? Well, turn with me firstly then to the very first few verses of the book of the Apocalypse, chapter 1, and we may as well go in at verse 1. Apocalypse chapter 1, verse 1, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John, who bare record of the word of God and of the testimony of Jesus Christ and of all things that he saw. Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand. So firstly then, we have a blessing. Blessed is he, says Brother Thomas Translate, that knows accurately, and they who give heed to the words of the prophecy, and narrowly observe the things which have been written in it, for the time is near. So first of all then, there's a blessing promised to those who narrowly observe, in other words, those who understand and give earnest heed, not just I understand a little bit here and there, that'll do. No, blessed are those who really try to get to grips with the things of this book, for the time is near. So right at the very start of this book, we are given to understand something concerning time. There's a reference to an element of time. So it's a theme in this book right from the outset. And all saints have had an interest in times and seasons. Daniel himself, the great man, in chapter 12, verse 8, said, I heard, but I understood not. Then said I, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? He was interested in time periods. He wanted to know when the end of those things predicted were. Of course, he wouldn't have been particularly enthusiastic about the things that were predicted because it was a period of downtreading. But he longed for the day when those things would come to an end, and he wanted to know when they would come to an end. And Paul, on a slightly different vein, says in Acts chapter 17, verse 30-31, to the Athenians, and the times of this ignorance God winked at, but now commandeth all men everywhere to repent, because he hath appointed a day in the which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, and that he hath raised him from the dead. So Paul was reminding them that God has appointed a day. There is a day appointed when he will judge the world in righteousness. Now, our interest in the time periods, our interest in that coming day, our interest in trying to establish when that coming day is, to a point, admittedly, not everyone is going to feel the energy to actually try to figure out exactly when Christ will return. Some have, we know, and for the most part have probably been wrong, Brother Thomas himself. But nevertheless, those who really earnestly look for the day when Christ will return to judge our world in righteousness and redeem his people Israel, natural and spiritual, it will go hand in hand that they will take a great interest in the periods of time predicted, not just in the book of the Apocalypse, but in Daniel and others, because it's the time of our redemption. The conclusions of these time periods that we will consider this morning are really just waymarkers bringing us closer and closer and closer to our redemption. How much do we want our redemption? If we have no interest in the prophecies of time, then perhaps it's an indication that our redemption isn't particularly important to us and we are quite happy with our kingdom in this world. There is, don't forget, a condemnation of those who fail to understand the signs of the times. Matthew chapter 16 verse 3, Christ told the Pharisees, "O ye hypocrites, ye can discern the face of the sky, but can ye not discern the signs of the times?" That was referring to some of the things that were about to transpire in their day. But nevertheless, that same principle applies to us. Are we able to discern the sign of the times? Are we able to see that we really are living in the latter days? Well, hopefully our address this morning will help us to establish some of these principles more clearly in our mind and realise that really little is remaining. And in fact, as far as the time period of the Apocalypse is concerned, nothing is remaining. As far as our understanding is concerned, so what time is near then? The time is at hand. What time is at hand? Brother Thomas says in Eureka Volume 1, the reason given why they are blessed who know accurately, give heed to, and observe narrowly the subject matter of the prophecy is because the time is near. The time of the prophecy. When the prophecy was given, that the seed of the woman should bruise the serpent's head, the time was not near. But in respect of this prophecy symbolizing the Apocalypse, the time is near. It began to be developed soon after it was published, and its development has been progressing onwards to its grand catastrophe ever since. Hence, all this long series of centuries from John to the Apocalypse of the Sons of the Deity, and the consummation of their mission and the establishment of the kingdom of their Father, and the overthrow of the enemy, is the time of the prophecy. End quote. So what Brother Thomas is saying then, the time of the end isn't near, or wasn't near at the time that John received the Apocalypse, but the time was near when the things predicted would start to be realised in the world, in the Roman world. And, as Brother Thomas correctly alluded to, that it would continue to unfold until he would come to take the kingdom to himself. So that the threatenings against the Nicolaitans, the threatenings against the Jezebels, the Balaamites, the liars, all those who try to subvert the truth, would soon, after John's day, begin to be felt. And Brother Matthew will sort of lead us on in some of that later on. So the purpose of having these time periods and correctly interpreting them then, well, as we've already made mention, people like Daniel wanted to know what the time periods were. Why? It would enable him to put bounds on the times of the Gentiles. Because the times of the Gentiles are the very antipathy to what a true saint wants. The Gentiles exercise lordship in cruel, tyrannical, or if not cruel and tyrannical, certainly very base and immoral ways. It enables us to sort of lay down a time when the holy city would be trodden underfoot. How long the witnesses would be put to death, etc. We want to be able to identify these periods of time. Another thing which is interesting as far as the prophecies of time are concerned is that they really are a marvellous testimony to the divine origins of the scriptures. So powerful are they in identifying certain things that some people erroneously and ridiculously tried to say that the book of Daniel was actually written 300 years after Christ. I think it was 300 years. Because his time periods had come to pass so accurately regarding and his predictions regarding the king of the north and the king of the south that it was almost uncanny, and people who wanted to reject the Bible said that it was written after the events. So that's a ridiculous argument and is easily refuted. But nevertheless, watching the time periods and analysing how they unfold is an example of one of the many examples to prove the veracity of the scriptures. And perhaps most importantly, regarding time periods and the purpose of them and our correct understanding of them, is that, somewhat like what Brother Ewan was saying yesterday, each generation of believers has been able to understand the apocalypse, give heed to, and observe narrowly the things which have been written therein, with the assistance of the time periods. Because we may be able to understand the beasts, we may be able to understand many of the symbols, but when we understand them in conjunction with the time periods predicted, it will add that extra weight and will prevent us allowing ourselves to be allied with any of those wicked systems predicted therein. For example, we may think that the beasts of the apocalypse relate to Rome, but perhaps without the assistance of the time periods, we may limit it to merely Constantine or merely the Holy Roman Empire in the days of the first few popes or something like that. But with the assistance of the time periods and being able to put sort of limits on these things, we really are able to identify the symbols correctly. I suppose they're kind of like markers in the water which warn us of rocks either side. We know there are rocks under the water. The time periods enable us to see where they are. Take for an example the book of the Apocalypse, chapter 12, verse 1, which will lead us on to our first actual consideration this morning. Apocalypse chapter 12, verse 1 says, "And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars." Well, look at verse 2. "And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth and pain to be delivered." Now, what would a true saint have seen in this? The apostasy doesn't even seem to have an issue identifying themselves with a woman clothed with the sun, with a moon under her feet and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. The European flag, the EU flag, for example, is made up purely of a blue background with 12 yellow stars on it. So Roman Catholicism has no problem identifying itself with the woman in verse 1. But what does a true saint see in that? Well, a true saint sees a time when the truth was no longer the chaste virgin that Paul endeavoured to espouse unto Christ. It sees that she had become a harlot, identifying themselves with all sorts of error, both in their walk and Christ-like or unchrist-like behaviour, and in adopting the notions of Plato and Socrates and all sorts of other errors, combining them with Judaism. So they would have identified a time period on a day for a year principle, and come back to that, of the gestative period, as Brother Thomas calls it, from a time when the truth holders began to apostatize. The gestative period, approximately 9 months, apparently accurately 280 days. So if we apply a day for a year principle, in other words, one day represents 1 year, then we have a time period of 280 years. So, where do we start and finish? Well, very shortly after the days of Christ, and in the days of the apostles, we read of the first account of deceit with Ananias and Sapphira. And Brother Thomas identifies that as the beginning of a creeping away from the sound, wholesome principles of the truth. Of course, Ananias and Sapphira were put to death instantly. But essentially what we have is the germ of apostasy in that spirit. And ultimately, it resulted in the greatest of all apostasies. In the days when Constantine, allegedly the champion of Christianity, truly the champion of false Christianity, became the emperor of Rome, the first alleged Christian emperor. That was 280 years after. And that is how a saint would see things like this in verse 1 of chapter 12. He would be able to identify these things. Whereas the apostasy thought, as the book of the Apocalypse says in verse 10 of that same chapter, the apostasy could see in the champion Constantine becoming emperor, now is salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before God day and night. They thought that the kingdom of God had come. They thought that this Christian emperor Constantine, who was an absolute rotter, killing his own mother and others in his family, being the first Christian emperor was the greatest thing ever to happen to them. But the true believer would have recognized that this was the birth of the man-child, the result, the final result of apostasy, and the germ which started in the deceit of Ananias and Sapphira. And Brother Thomas says, the Apocalypse is a book of symbols, in which the greater is represented by the less. Its agents and their operations, and its times preliminary to the 1,000 years, are all miniature representations of the reality. Great things illustrated by small. So that's an interesting thing to bear in mind here. When we talk about a day for a year principle, or anything for that matter, we're not trying to represent, for example, a day represents an hour. We're always talking about a day representing something greater. And that's the same in most walks of life. You can take, when they test aircraft, they will test miniature versions in the wind tunnels to get the aerodynamic properties of that aircraft before they actually build the final product. Road signs, the same. They're all miniatures. They're all miniatures of something that will actually happen, or it will be built, whatever. And the book of the Apocalypse is no different. And yet, despite that, so many people want to interpret it as literal days. But it's ridiculous and out of... it's actually out of our scope for consideration this morning. But this is the truth of the prophecy, whether the truth be literally stated or by symbols. The verbal always falls short of the real, which is joy unspeakable and full of glory, things which cannot be expressed. Because of the Spirit's working by this rule, it is that so much has been revealed in so small a book. It is a condensed view of the deep things of the deity, which, if they had been magnitudinously revealed, I suppose, as John says, that even the cosmos itself could not contain the books that should be written. Condensation, then, says Brother Thomas, is the general principle of divine revelation, but of the symbols it is the special. The apocalyptic times are an apportionment of the times of the Holy City or of the saints, concurrent with the times of the Gentiles, during which Jerusalem's polity, Hebrew and Christian, is trodden under their feet. Hence, Jerusalem has her times, and the Gentiles have theirs, but the two sets of times are not times of concurrent prosperity and triumph. So then, this Brother Thomas accepted a day for a year principle, I've already mentioned it. Is it preeminently reasonable, and is it a correct approach? Look at Genesis 47 verse 9. And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage. So right back in Genesis 47 verse 9, we get a hint of days representing years. But look at Numbers chapter 14. Having rebelled after the ten spies brought back an evil report, Moses says, or Yahweh says through Moses, and your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years and bear your whoredoms, until your carcasses be wasted in the wilderness. After the number of the days in which ye searched the land, even 40 days, each day for a year, shall ye bear your iniquities, even 40 years, and ye shall know my breach of promise. So there we have the day for a year clearly laid out, and it was applied for the children of Israel to know that as they sent the spies out into the land for 40 days, so they would wander in the wilderness for a total of 40 years. And lastly, well, there are actually others, but this is the last one we'll take this morning. Ezekiel chapter 4 verse 4, "Lie thou also upon thy left side, and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it, according to the number of the days that thou shalt lie upon it, thou shalt bear their iniquity. For I have laid upon thee the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days. So shalt thou bear the iniquity of the house of Israel." So this day for a year principle then is not unreasonable, and it's founded in the Old Testament. Accepting this day for a year principle, we suddenly find that the prophecies become vitally more interesting and much more meaningful. And we may say that if we accepted them literally as a day for a day, or for that matter a month for a month, the prophecies would be fairly meaningless, and aside from being incorrect, would take away the whole beauty of the book of the Apocalypse. So then, let's move on to our first consideration then, 5 months. Let's turn to Apocalypse chapter 9 verse 5. Apocalypse chapter 9 verse 5, we'll read verse 1, I suppose we can read the 5 verses there. Of course, I'm actually sort of invading Ben's airspace, Brother Ben's airspace here, in that he will deal with the trumpets, but we'll identify the time periods and leave Brother Ben to deal with the bulk of the detail. So chapter 9 verse 1, "And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads." Now, I leave most of that detail for Brother Ben to consider. But look at verse 4. We're in the period here of the fifth trumpet. And we are in the time, not of pagan Rome, but of Catholic Rome. Or false Christian Rome. Only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. A very interesting section Brother Thomas has in Eureka, which is worth reading regarding the seal of God in the foreheads. But essentially here, we are talking about those who claim to be Christian, but do not have the truth, and they are therefore not sealed in the foreheads. It was against those that the judgments of the fifth angel trumpeter was brought against the bear. And verse 5 says, "To them it was given that they should not kill them." In other words, they were not to bring an end to the power of the empire or the east, but that they should be tormented 5 months. And their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. So here we have a time period of 5 months. Literally 5 months? Or do we apply the day for a year principle? Well, based on what we've already said, I think we can safely say that we will apply the day for a year principle. So there are 30 days in Hebrew month, all day months, and 5 of them makes 150 days. So using the day for a year principle, we have 150 years. Now there are actually 2 periods of 5 months represented here. If you look at verse 10, it continues, "They had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months." Why not 10 months? Why do we not have 10 months given here? Well, bear in mind, the book of the Apocalypse uses symbol, and it uses realistic symbols. We have the locust represented here. So the decorum of the symbol actually prevents the scriptures saying 10 months, because locusts only live for 5 months. They operate for part of April, May, June, July, August, and part of September, a total of 5 months. So we couldn't say that a locust in symbol operates for 10 months. But 5 months was insufficient to carry out the work that God wanted the locusts to carry out. And so we give them 2 periods of 5 months, which essentially are the same thing, but it keeps the symbol intelligible. Brother Thomas says, yet it would seem that they could not do all the tormenting and injuring they were appointed to do against the shaven crowns. By shaven crowns, we can instantly picture what we mean, what is meant there. The Catholics with all their monks and abominable type people like that, and their deluded votaries in one season of 5 months, but in 2 seasons. The decorum of the symbols, therefore, rejected the record of 10 months and required the time to be expressed symbolically twice by 5 months. So, where does this start? Where does the time period to begin and where does it end? Well, if you find one or the other, then we know, we can identify both ends of the time period. So where did the locusts begin? Verse 7 is a clue. The shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle, and on their heads were as it were crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men. This was in the time period where the Catholics would not grow beards at all. So they had faces of men, the Apocalypse says. And they also had on their heads crowns like gold. Who were these people? Well, if we go back to the early 7th century, the world knows well of a man by the name of Muhammad. He embarked on an ambitious career, coming out of obscurity and almost persecution, to establish what's known as the Faith of Islam. He had to conquer the idolatrous Arabs before he could do anything. And this was the work, this was the smouldering, if you like, the preparation of the smoke, which commenced the burning process, which resulted in the smoke erupting through the abyss into Eastern Europe. Muhammad died in AD 632. So he was not the work as such, but he was the preparation of the work for this fifth trumpet period. He was succeeded by Abu Bakr, and it was this succession, just as a point of interest, that created the divide in the Muslim faith between the Sunnis and the Shiites. The Shiites don't accept the legitimate success of Abu Bakr, but the Sunnis do, and there has been that division ever since their inception. So it was Abu Bakr then, in the year AD 632, that began to move north into the period of the Middle East, into like Israel and the Levant, and up into Eastern Europe. And this is the year regarded by Dr. Thomas as the commencement of the 5 months, fulfilling the fourth verse. So that was in AD 632, and if we add 150 years to that, we come to 782. So we should look for something to mark the end of the first period of 5 months. Nothing necessarily that brought an end to the power, because remember, their power couldn't be brought to an end. It had to carry out the work of God for a period of 300 years, 2 periods of 5 months. But in 782 AD, the Greeks revolted against the Saracens. They revolted against the Caliph, because the Saracens were engaged in internal civil war. So that's from AD 632 to AD 782. That's our first period of 5 months. So what about the second period then? Well, it continues immediately afterwards. So it keeps running, if you like. And the war essentially carried on. There are reports, like on Cyprus, of mass bloodshed, where Catholics were slain by these by the Saracens, who actually promoted peace to those who held fast the truth, we believe. But to those who worshipped idols, those who bowed down to images like of Mary, of Saint Peter, Saint Paul, you name it, all those Catholic type forms of worship, they were the people that suffered at the hands of the Saracens. But, as with everything, the Caliph became powerful and they ceased to really want to extend their borders. And by 932 AD, they were so comfortable and so at ease that their ambitious career was essentially at an end. And in 932, a group of like Muslims, just a different sect, I think they were the Shiites, wrested supreme authority from the Caliph. And that essentially brought an end to the tormenting period that God had appointed for the Saracen locusts against the idol-worshipping Romans of the East. So there we go, from the beginning in AD 632 to AD 782 is the first period of 5 months, and from 782 to 932 is the second period of 5 months, bringing an end to that total 300-year scourge of the Eastern Europeans, the idol worshippers, those who had not the seal of God in their foreheads. So let's move on now then to our next time period, closely linked, very closely linked in fact, and is actually dependent on the work of the first trumpet. An hour, a day, and a month, and a year. Verse 15 of the same chapter, now verse 14. And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which are prepared for an hour, and a day, and a month, and a year, for to slay the third part of men. So here we are then, we're in the sixth trumpet here, which as Brother Ben will bring up later, is the second woe trumpet. So we have our same considerations then. When does this period start? This hour, day, month, and year. How long is it, I suppose? And what do these four angels represent? Well, the four angels simply represent four powers. They represent four powers for the next series of judgments on the idolatrous Catholics of the East. There was this difference. In verse 5 of chapter 9, to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented. So the first, the fifth trumpet, would not bring an end to the Roman Empire, or to the East part of the Roman Empire. By contrast, the work of the angels did. And Brother Thomas says quickly, what then could be done with such an incorrigible generation of demonial and idol worshippers, but to prepare powers which, when loosed against them, should proclaim idolatry, a sin punishable with slavery or death? This was the course of the eternal spirit, as revealed in the vision of the second woe, the sixth trumpet. The Euphrathian powers were prepared powers, powers prepared for a special mission, and therefore angels or messengers, and messengers are so called because they are sent to perform or execute missions. The mission of these Euphrathians was to make war upon idolatry with sword and gun, until the dominion of the Eastern Dragonic Third should be transferred to the conqueror, and so in relation to the demonian idol-worshipping community, to all intents and purposes, killed. We may recall the words of Napoleon, who said, the hand of God guides my armies. He didn't realise how true he was. The hand of God did guide his armies. And the hand of God, that same hand, the providential hand of God, guided these four angel powers. Who were these four angel powers? Simply, because I can't go into too much detail, the Seljuks, the Mughals, the Tartars, and the Ottomans. Essentially, summarise who these four angel powers were. And they operated one after the other. The loosing of them is not to be confused with the preparing of them. For example, Genghis Khan was the great champion of the Mughals, but he was not the one to actually exercise the divine command to scourge and to slay the Catholics of the East. He was only the character, great character, to prepare the work for that angel. So what about the time period then? Well, again, applying a day for a year principle, we can break it up in the fractions that we have. An hour is the 12th of a day, a Hebrew day, We tend to break our days up into 24 hours, but essentially the Hebrews break their days up into a 12-hour day and a 12-hour night, bringing us to the total of 24 hours. So if we assume that an hour is a 12th of a day, on the same principle, we'll divide a year up and find, by the same proportion, and find that we have a month. Likewise, we have a day for a year. A month is 30 days, so we have 30 years. And a year is 360 days. Bearing in mind, we're talking Hebrew year, we're on the Hebrew calendar, and a Hebrew year is made up of 360 days, not 365 and a quarter like ours is, not 365. So add all those together, and we have 391 years and a month. So that is the time period that we can use to identify the operation of these four angel powers. And it commenced on the 29th of April, Brother Thomas identifies, 29th of April, 1062. Shortly before the death of Togrul Beg, who was the preparing of the first angel. And it essentially ceased with the work in 1092. Alp Arslan, who was of the Seljuks, one of Togrul Beg's generals, I believe, although Ben may correct me later on that, crossed the Euphrates in 1063. And that is what we are looking for here. The river Euphrates bound these powers until they were providentially loosed. It was when they crossed the river Euphrates is when the work of God really began. Prior to that, they were in the preparation stage. When they crossed the river Euphrates, that I should have had a map really to help us here, but it is only then that they would exercise the judgments against the idol worshipping east. The second angel, the Mughals or Mongols. We get the modern day Mongolia, and there's an absolutely enormous statue of Genghis Khan in I forget the name of the chief city in Mongolia, to recognize the great work of Genghis Khan. In some ways, he actually established the greatest empire the earth had ever known. It occupied a quarter of the world's longitude. But he wasn't the one that was actually used by Yahweh to exercise the work. He was merely the preparation. And it was his son, Oktay Khan, who invaded Eastern Europe, crossing the Euphrates to do so in 1241. The third angel, Tamerlane, or Timur, had inspired the respect of his enemies, who he became so powerful that his enemies, particularly those in the Catholic East, concluded that fortune and divine favour were with him. They were right. Loosed in 1402, he crossed the Euphrates in 1402 and continued for a very short time, only 3 years, until 1405. It is said that in his entire a career, 13 million perished at his hands, most of which would have been the Catholic worship, the Catholic East. Inadvertently, the Catholics helped to prepare the next angel, the Ottoman angel, because they helped the Ottomans in hoping that the Ottomans would weaken the power of Timur or Tamerlane, saying that they preferred the enemy they could handle to the one that they could not. Well, that's what they thought, but it was to be the Ottomans who weakened the eastern part of Rome right up until this day. Amurath I began his work against the east And it was completed on that famous day, in May 1453, when the streets of Constantinople ran with blood, with the Ottomans in control of Eastern Europe. Remember, Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul, was the seat of the dragon. It was the place where Constantine had set his throne, and it was now in the hands of the Muslims, and is to this day. That then is the time period of the woe trumpets, I suppose, which we will consider later on today. And now we must move on to our next time period. We have three time periods which run somewhat concurrently here. We have two mentions of 42 months, and we have one mention of 1260 days. In chapter 11, verse 2, we have a mention of 42 months. In verse 3 of the same chapter, we have 1260 days. And in chapter 13, verse 5, we have 42 months mentioned again. Well, if you think about it, 42 months is actually 1260 days. On the Hebrew month, of course. So what we have is all three representing 1260 days, which again represents 1260 years. So why are they different? Why did the deity choose to represent a time period by 1260 days, and then an exactly same length of duration by 42 months? Well, before we consider that, we once again throw in the argument that the day for a year principle is correct. Brother Thomas says, but are these 42 months simply months of days, or are they symbolic months of days, each day signifying a year? To affirm that they are months of days and nothing more would be a violation of all decorum. To have evolved a scriptural exposition of the reed, the rod, the angel, the nave, the altar, the court, and the city, and to have shown that John and his actions were representative, and then to affirm that the time related to these things is to be expounded upon an entirely opposite principle, that the time is literal months and no more, is irrational, contrary to the analogy of scripture, incongruous to the subject treated of, and, importantly, contrary to historic fact. Nearly 1800 years have elapsed since John saw the vision of the 11th chapter. When he saw it, the one body was in the altar worshipping in sackcloth situation. It was then warred upon by the pagan Roman power, the little horn with the eyes of a man and a blaspheming mouth, having then no existence in the court of the Gentiles. But instead of being prevailed against, overcome and killed, the one body overcame the great red Roman dragon by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. It was not trodden underfoot of pagan Rome, but Rome pagan is placed under its feet, under the symbol of a woman with the moon under her feet. Hence there is no sense in which it could then be said of the body, the holy city shall the Gentiles trample 42 months of days and days only. For history shows that the trampling was the reverse of this, and that the conflict between the pagan dragon and the holy city, neither 42 months nor 1260 days, nor 1260 years, but the much shorter period of 226 years from the time John measured the holy city until the dragon was cast out into the earth. So, what Brother Thomas is saying is when John saw it, it was under pagan Rome. Well, we cannot identify the 42 months as anything to do with pagan Rome, because pagan Rome was only to continue for a short space, relatively short space, after John's day, so it has nothing to do with pagan Rome, unless we are to assume that it is 42 literal months, which is utterly ridiculous. That is too short for anything to be worth symbolizing. It has then to be papal Rome, on the grounds that the one body wasn't always trampled underfoot by the pagan Roman emperors. Take, for example, the rotter Commodus. He has one of the most infamous names of all the Roman emperors, and yet he was favourable to Christians. So it is not true to say that pagan Rome can be represented by this time period. However, there has been no time under the rule of Catholic Roman emperors, or in any time of the Holy Roman Empire, that truth holders have ever been held in favourable view. They have always been the enemy of Catholicism. And therefore, historical fact shows, aside from anything else, that the 42 months has reference to the time when false Christianity was in power. Nothing to do with paganism. So, going back to that question, and why do we have 42 months of days and 1260 days presented to us? Why are they different? Why are they differently symbolised? Well, they represent two different things. So there are different aspects represented, and there are also different start and end times, which we shall see in a moment. In chapter 11, verse 2, turn there quickly, we have, "The court which is without the temple leave out, and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. And then in verse 3, "I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth." So, we have two different things represented there. We have a downtreading of 42 months, and we have a witnessing of 1,260 days. So that's the first reason why the Spirit has decided to use two different symbols. And then in 13 verse 5, we have an identification with the, an aid to identify what we are talking about in verse 2 of chapter 11. 13 verse 5 says, "There was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. So we have a mouth speaking great blasphemies, and the holy city treading underfoot 42 months. Now, I know everyone in this room already understands who is represented there, but we look into that in a short time. So starting with verse 3, because this actually starts first in the period of history, "I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth." So we're looking for a time then when the two witnesses, who were the two witnesses? Well, Brother Thomas clearly identifies the two witnesses as being a secular or sort of political witness and a religious witness. Now, the political witness would not have had any truth holders in it because the truth holders aren't involved in politics or anything secular. But amongst the religious element of the two witnesses, we would have had the truth holders. We would have had false Christianity, like that taught by John Calvin and Martin Luther and so on. They would have been witnesses against Rome, but not truth holders. But amongst that body of witnesses, there would have been those holding the truth. And they were witnessing against who? A system of blasphemy identified in chapter 13, verse 5, and the power that would tread them underfoot, 42 months. So, it's easy to identify who that is. It's not anything to do with pagan Rome. It can only be the Holy Roman Empire. It can only be the papal system of blasphemy, Babylon the Great. Paul said, 1 Thessalonians, "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he, as God, sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." Brother Ewan only slightly hinted yesterday with these Lateran councils just how much authority the Pope has tried to bring to himself. And as late as the 1870s, the Pope declared himself infallible. Vicarius Dies is God's vicar on earth. There is no one that is greater than the Pope in the earth. And so he sits in the temple of God, identifying himself, whether he like it or not, with the Apocalypse, chapter 13, verse 5, a mouth speaking great blasphemy. And, for the most part, unashamedly, treading underfoot the holy city, which we will have to identify shortly. So, when do we start? Oh, well, first of all, what are the characteristics to look for in the witnessing? is not a sense of preaching, as in the apostolic preaching, that ended with the ending of the period of the white horse in 300, the period of the seals in 312, essentially. That was the end of that the work of the arrowless bowmen. So it's not preaching. It's witnessing in sackcloth. Now we witness today. We don't go throughout the empires of the world preaching, but we do witness to the fact that Christ will return. We do witness in that we refuse to be associated with the things of the world. But we don't witness in sackcloth today, because the power of persecution has been removed. So the witnessing in sackcloth is no longer identifiable with us. But for the most part of history since Christ, the witnesses have had to witness in sackcloth because of their persecution. So what we need to identify then is a time period when there was something tangible to witness against. It wasn't pagan Rome again, we will say, because pagan Rome was pagan. That wasn't anything you had to witness against. However, there came a time when there were those who professed to hold Christianity and exercised their false Christianity and left the true believers no alternative but to witness against it, to refuse to be identified with it. Now that, we will submit to you, is start in the year AD 312. We're in the time period of Constantine, when Constantine had won his victory against Maxentius. And we had amongst the two witnesses, if you like, the formation of these witnesses here, with the Donatists. But in Carthage, I believe it was, there was a man by the name of Caecilianus, and he was elected to be the bishop, the overseer. Now, he had a track record of persecuting his brethren, and to avoid persecution by the pagan authorities, he had submitted his Bible to be burnt so that he could save his life. So this was the kind of person that was elected as a bishop. Now, he was elected by a Christian majority, which shows what the state of Christianity was like then. But the group, the Donatists, who we don't know whether they had the truth or not, there probably were some who had the truth amongst them, but they refused to accept this bishop. And they seceded from this church and had nothing more to do with it. And they refused into their fellowship any from the state church. This was, we believe, the beginning of the witnessing period. They suffered as a result in that people like Caecilianus went to Constantine to gain their favour, to gain Constantine's favour on their side, which they were successful with. So this then was the beginning of the period of the witnessing. And it's not difficult to identify the beginning, and it's even more clear when we see what happens when we add 1,260 years to it. 1572. A very famous year in the religious history. The year when, on the day of St. Bartholomew's Day, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of so-called heretics were slain. It said that 30,000 Protestants actually lost their lives in France. We need to bear this in mind, in the sense that 1572 marked the beginning of the end of the ability of there to be any witnesses amongst the Roman Empire at all, because they had ceased to witness. Now the Edict of Milan in AD 313 proclaimed freedom to Christians, but there's a caveat to that, because it withdrew freedom to heretics. So just because you said you were a Christian as opposed to a pagan did not entitle you to freedom. So as soon then as the man-child of Apocalypse 12 was brought forth, he began to discriminate and persecute the woman. And that's when the woman was forced to flee to the wings of the empire, the extremities, if you like. Not the major cities, not the coastline, but the extremities, like the Alps, like northern Roman Africa. And Brother Thomas says, at the end of these centuries, she disappeared from the African wing of the great eagle and manifested her presence in Armenia, that Eastern Europe, and Asia Minor. And when she could no longer find food and nourishment there, she migrated in the course of 150 years into France. Okay, I'm going to stop that quote right there because I'm running out of time. But anyway, Brother Thomas goes on to show that before long, there was nowhere to hide. There was nowhere to flee. The tentacles of Rome had gone throughout all Europe and had made it too difficult to flee. And by 1572, a period began when there would be mass persecution. And of course, we're aware of like the Spanish Inquisition, which was all around at that time as well. What about the treading underfoot of 40 and 2 months? The holy city shall they tread underfoot 40 and 2 months. What is the holy city? What is the court of the Gentiles? And when, of course, does the 42 months, or 1,260 years, begin and end? Well, John was told in verse 1, there was given unto me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, rise and measure the temple of God, and the altar and them that worship therein. Like unto a rod, this rod is rabdos in the Greek, which is a rod of correction, it's said, like for beating slaves and whatever. So we have here a period of trial or chastisement. And Paul says in Hebrews 12 verse 6, for whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. Ease and prosperity, brethren and sisters, does nothing to help the characteristics of the truth. But whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. And essentially, what John saw here was a time period when the holy city would be measured with a rod of correction. Now, in the temple built by Solomon, we have several courts. We have the court of the Gentiles, we have the court of the Israelites, we have the court of the priests, and there was no intermingling between those courts. We have the holy place and we have the most holy place. In the apocalyptic arrangement, we merely have the unmeasured outer court, which was comprised of all sorts of people, Jews and Gentiles, who had not the truth. And then we have symbolized in various places, 11 verse 1, for example, the altar, them that worship therein, the court of the priests, and the holy place are all one. And they're surrounded by the court of the Gentiles. Likewise, the holy city represents the same thing. So the altar, the court of the priests, the holy place, and the holy city all represent the same thing. It is that body of people, very, very small for the most part, who hold fast to the truth and the commandments of Christ. We were going to turn there, but we don't have time. There's two measurings of this, the temple. The holy city is measured twice, here in verse 1 of chapter 11, and also in 21 verse 15. Here, in the pre-resurrectional state, in chapter 21, in the post-resurrectional state. So John measures the holy city with the rod of correction here. In chapter 21, the rod of correction isn't seen, because it's post-resurrectional. The reward has been given. 11 verse 4, these are the two olive trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth. Who is the God of the earth? Well, we've already identified that, I think, in 2 Thessalonians. It's him that exalts himself above all that is called God, even the Pope himself. The little horn with eyes and mouth of Daniel. He, the lamb, he that was looked as a lamb but spake as a dragon, which spoke great blasphemies. The papal see. So then, when do these 42 months start? When do we identify the downtreading of the 42 months? Well, it would seem, based on what Brother Thomas says, we could take it from AD 799 or AD 800, when Charlemagne annexed the three horn powers to the Pope. And essentially began the Holy Roman Empire. But Brother Thomas doesn't take it there, for what he says is that nothing happens overnight. AD 799 was not the start of papal power of blasphemy. It started much earlier than that. It was a hideous system, to be true, in the time of Constantine. But the power that the Pope came to have was nothing in the time of Constantine. All we knew of then was a bishop of Rome. But it grew and it grew over succeeding centuries. As Daniel 7 says, he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until the time and times and the dividing of time. This is the same time period, and represents the same time period. So let's work back then from a terminal date. Between AD 324, that was when Licinius was defeated at the Battle of Adrianople, to the year AD 608, this papal power was just growing and growing and growing. This God of guardian saints, as Brother Thomas translates the words in Daniel, basically the Bishop of Rome, the bishop who sort of is the chief of the idolatry, just grew and grew and grew in power. He was aided by some of the emperors. For example, in AD 529, we have what's known as Justinian's Court. It actually laid the foundation of the Holy Roman Emperor. And there was some interesting comments on that, which we don't have time to go into, sadly, around the time of the French Revolution. Very interesting. But the upshot of this was in part to secure Christianity as the state religion. But it also inculcated laws against heresy. Now, what is heresy? Anything that the Bishop of Rome said was wrong. That by definition was heresy. So all non-Christians are now non-citizens as a result of Justinian's Court. Now that's interesting. We can see where that was headed. All non-Christians are now non-citizens. How many of us have had discussions with Christians who said, I'm sorry, I don't think you're a Christian if you don't believe the Trinity? That all stems from the work of the Bishop of Rome, partly originating in Justinian's Court, who basically said that all non-Christians are non-citizens. It became for the Bishop of Rome to identify who were Christians and who weren't, not for God to say who were true Christians and who weren't, but for the Pope. The Pope had all jurisdiction, so he thinks. And in AD 533, he submitted his Decretal Epistle, which said that the Roman bishop has universal supremacy. So we can see where this is headed. 75 years later, I'm sorry, so we have what we have like a sort of a 4-year window, I suppose. 529 plus 1260 takes us to the interesting year of 1789, and 533 added to the same period, the 1793, the period of the French Revolution. So that's the first period of 42 months. We'll come back to that just very quickly. We don't have much to say on that. But Brother Thomas says, 75 years after this quickening, he was born God of the Roman Earth by Phocas, the Dragon Emperor. Now, Phocas is regarded very highly by Catholics, and it's quite appropriate that he is so, because he was an utter debauched rotter. And fits quite nicely in with Catholicism, I suppose. But he gave the Pope such authority because he made him the head of all churches. He declared the Pope to be the universal bishop. I think that's wrong. Anyway, the Pope was actually made to be the head of all the churches. He was now essentially the head. He was the last word in all religious affairs, and much more than that as well. Now, I don't have any time to read what Brother Thomas has to say here, but read about the Dragon Age, the Spanish Inquisition. This was all possible as a result of the work of firstly Justinian and then Phocas, who gave the Pope absolute authority. If the Pope said to do something, people like Queen Isabella truly were happy to do it, but they did it because of the authority of the Pope. It was very, very difficult. It's really, really very difficult for us to understand today just how much power Roman Catholicism had. You couldn't print a book without the authority of the bishop. You barely could do anything without the authority of the bishop. people like to think about human rights today, they need to look back at some history and realize just how few rights people really had back in the days of Roman Catholicism. If the Pope or the Bishop or whatever said something, it was, excuse the phrase, gospel. That was it. There was no recourse. And Paul says, others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with a sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains, and in dens and caves of the earth. It's rather sobering when we think that we hope to be alongside some of these people when they execute the judgments written. We want to execute the judgments against Roman Catholicism, and yet we haven't been treated like these have been treated. So, 529 plus 1260 takes us to 1789, the year when the French Revolution commenced. And what did that do? People don't realise it today. People think it was a revolt against authority, against, you know, sort of tyrannical and unreasonable rulers. Yes, it was. But who were those rulers? They were the people appointed by the Papal See. King Louis XIV, when he revoked the Edict of Nantes in 1685, he didn't do it alone. He had the blessing of the Jesuits. He had the blessing of the Pope in doing this. And interestingly, when Louis XVI was called upon to acknowledge the revolution, the Pope excommunicated him. This was all against the papacy. It's not, as history says, just purely against tyranny. Yes, it is against tyranny, but not the tyranny of the Louis. It was the tyranny of the papacy. And then in 1864, so that was the first start, I should say, of the weakening of the papal influence. No longer could the popes bark these papal bulls and excommunicate people and commit people to prison and torture and death. Certainly not in France. But by 1864, with the work of Victor Emmanuel, and or rather Garibaldi, who made Victor Emmanuel king of the papal states, the Pope lost temporal power altogether. So there we have the parallelogram, if you like, which sort of represents the 75-year sort of delay in the as we sort of ramp up the power of the Pope, and then a 75-year delay again then at the end between the time of the French Revolution, which really started the weakening of the papacy, to 1864, when the Pope lost all temporal power. And that takes us on to the 3.5 days death of the witnesses when they revived in 1789, but we're not going to consider that now because I'm out of time. That's a time frame just to give you some sort of pictorial idea of the of where we are in the mall. You can see that although we considered the 5 months, or the two periods of 5 months first, that was at 632. And this, I put this together really to give us some context, because otherwise sometimes you can start throwing some things long, long way ago, a long time ago in history, like perhaps 1453, we may think is like hundreds of years ago. Well, it was only 2 years later that Gutenberg invented the printing press. It was only something like 40 years after that that the Wars of the Roses took place. So, I put that there hopefully to just sort of put the time frames as a with contextually, I suppose. So then, moving on to our last time period then, a significant time period. We've had a couple of others which we haven't dealt with. We've dealt with the significant ones, and there's one more significant one which we wish to deal with, and it's a glorious one. Let's turn to the Book of the Apocalypse, chapter 20, and verse 2. Or verse 1. I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit, and a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. Now, someone may say to us, now we're bound to apply the day for a year principle again. But we would have to say, why would we apply a day for a year principle here? There are some things in Scripture which are symbolic. And essentially, what we have to do first is understand the truth. That's the first thing. We can never hope to understand the book of Revelation if we don't understand the truth. But the second thing we have to do is look at the context. When we think about 1,260 days or 42 months, we have to look at the context. Or, for example, the 3.5 days death of the witnesses. When we read the symbols there, we read of an upheaval when the witnesses revive, and at their previous death, we read of great celebrations throughout the Roman Empire. Well, do we really seriously think that the death of witnesses for 3.5 days, even if it is a literal death, or if it is a symbolic death for that matter, would really give way to that kind of depth of symbol? I would submit to you that that would be ridiculous. So we have to understand the context of these things. 1,000 years is a reasonable time frame to take literally. If we started applying a day for a year principle to that, we'd end up with a massive time period. And the context does not suggest that we need to interpret this any differently. So here we have an occasion in the apocalypse where the time is literally given. The other thing, obviously, to bear in mind is that we look for the creation as our guide on this point. We had 6 days of creation, which roughly represents 6,000-year reign of man, on the seventh day of which God rested. So if we have approximately 6,000 years reign of man, we have a 7,000th-year reign of Yahweh, or Christ, who is obviously God's Son. So then, what is the purpose of this 1,000 years? Well, verse 2 tells us, he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. We are apt to think that the 1,000 years is the end of everything. But as Brother Robert so well named one of his lectures, it is the final instrumentality in the great scheme of human redemption. It's not the end in itself, but it is the final instrumentality. All the kingdoms of the world have been broken. Christ now becomes the ruler over the whole earth. But that's not quite the end. That's not the end of the picture, if you like. So what then do we understand by the binding of the dragon? How is the false prophet and Daniel's fourth beast destroyed, and yet the dragon remains? Does that not make things a little confusing? To a point, but let's remember then, what was the dragon? The dragon was the false accuser in the days of John. It was pagan and it was anti-Christian. It was the great red dragon. But in AD 312, that dragon changed his identity and became Christian. He continued seated in Rome until he ceded his throne to the beast of the sea in AD 800 with Charlemagne's inaugural Holy Roman Empire. Thereafter, we find the dragon seated in Constantinople, which was the seat of the power, until 1453. And since then, it's been occupied by a race which does not belong to the apocalyptic synagogue of the Satan. It is to be expelled, obviously. It is to be expelled by the Russian, who will unite all the toes or the horns of Europe. And once again, will be the dragon seated in Constantinople. But for now, it's occupied by Islam. And the paganism, Constantinople was Greek. And the Christianity, Constantinople was Greek, and therefore must become Greek again, before the great day of El Shaddai, when the dragon is bound. So, that's the identification of the dragon. How is it not slain along with the false prophet? Well, the dragon does not essentially represent any particular form of Satan's government. The beast does. The beast represents Roman Catholicism, the Holy Roman Empire. And so does the false prophet. The false prophet represents that system of the papacy. So the beast then, being the Holy Roman Empire, the false prophet being the Pope, the dragon is essentially, pure and simply, sin's flesh in government. And with a special reference to Yahweh's people and how they deal with Yahweh's people. Thus, we are informed that although governments are broken as a potter's vessel in the prophets, sin's flesh in political manifestation is not to be destroyed. It is to be chained or bound for 1,000 years. And we understand in verse 2 that there will be a political rebellion at the end of 1,000 years. I'll read Brother Thomas very quickly. This mere human power is to remain in the national abyss without dominion. Sin's flesh is to be turned out of office and to exist only in absolute subjection to spirit as manifested in Jesus and his brethren. All the glorified sons of the deity rule in the habitable in righteousness for 1,000 years. To keep sin's flesh so long accustomed to rule and revel in its own lusts and superstitions in subjection will require a government strong as iron. The necessity is provided for. For it is written, he shall rule the nations with a rod of iron, so that no deceivers will be permitted to ply mankind with their sorceries, causing them to err from the way of truth and righteousness. But after 1,000 years have passed, the angel will relax his grip on that great chain. And if you read Eureka Volume 5, page 322, if you have the Brown, you'll see how Brother Thomas envisages the rebellion. And you have these people who, essentially, because they allow the flesh to govern them as opposed to the spirit, they will become irritable with the rule of the spirit and will endeavour to overthrow the rule of Christ, which will meet with a miserable destruction. Verse 1-6 says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband, and heard a great voice out of heaven, saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them, and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said unto me, write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said unto me, it is done. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of the water of life freely. What about us, brethren and sisters? He that overcometh shall inherit all things. And I will be his God, and he shall be my son.